I don't know who you are. I don't know what you want. If you're looking for a ransom, I can tell you I don't have money. But what I do have are a very particular set of skills. Skills I have acquired over a very long career. Skills that make me a nightmare for people like you. If you let my daughter go now, that will be the end of it. I will not look for you. I will not pursue you. But if you don't, I will look for you. I will find you. And I will kill you. Liam Neeson there. Dominic Sandbrook.
What
course.
Accent?
Who else?
What
Who
accent
else?
Was that?
Who else?
That was like a man from Norfolk.
It wasn't. No, it was an American-Irish accent.
What? With a that deep, was absolutely with a shocking.
Deep, with a deep, manly timbre.
You did a fantastic New York Times. You did
Dominic,
Edward
well,
Heath, and then it's all gone wrong.
No, it hasn't. That was absolutely superb. And the reason that I've chosen to open an episode that is on the CIA with that
yes.
is because in that, Liam Neeson is playing Brian Mills, whose daughter gets abducted. And he brings the skill set of a CIA agent. But at no point in that film does he mention that he's in the CIA because he doesn't need to.
All right.
He doesn't need to because it can be automatically assumed that, you know, these are the skills that he has. And it gives him the kind of the aura of combined competence and menace that the CIA at its best wants to convey.
And that people associate with the hosts of this podcast.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. So, but as someone who doesn't know a huge amount about the CIA, what I'd yes. like to know is, are they as menacing and are they as competent as Liam Neeson might imply in that
well,
film?
I thought that for this podcast, we needed somebody who was competent and menacing, but also had an interestingly transatlantic accent, a bit like the accent you were just doing. So when I first met him, he was a man very much of the West Country who taught alongside me at the University of Sheffield. But he's since moved to California, and listeners may be able to detect a little bit of kind of the Prince Harry in his in his voice, if not his demeanor and outlook, I hope. So this is Professor Hugh Wilford, who is one of the world's leading authorities. I would say the leading authority.
Because the top authority.
The top authority. The absolute supremo of CIA studies. So, Hugh, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me. It's a very pleasure to be here.
Excellent. So there you've got the accent
straight
away.
Especially after that introduction.
There you've got the accent, you've got the tone of menace, and the competence. All there.
I'm known for my tone of menace. Oh, yes. People are picking a mark on it.
So Hugh, as I've said, I am incredibly ignorant about the CIA beyond obviously my amazing ability to do impersonations of Liam Neeson. And what I'm wondering is, the CIA, America doesn't have a kind of central intelligence agency before the war, does it? Before the Second World War?
That's correct. It does not.
And am I right that it's basically modeled on the British example? And the CIA agents to begin with all sit around smoking pipes and wearing tweed jackets and things.
That's about right. Yeah, there's no sort of national intelligence service. Throughout American history, the pattern has sort of been that intelligence services are sort of patched together during war and then dismantled rapidly afterwards because, you know, Americans don't like secrecy. They don't like big government, etc. But the Office of Strategic Services is created during World War II, and it is absolutely right, sort of largely based on a British model, and the British actually are sort of on the sidelines urging the Americans to go down the intelligence route as they have several years before. And so there is this kind of, but certainly in the early days, there is this kind of very strong Anglophile, almost sort of faux imperial British tone to the CIA.
So that's the pipe smoking. Because when you see, I agree with Tom, whenever you see pictures of early CIA men, they are wearing tweed jackets and sitting in kind of leather armchairs and smoking pipes and stuff, aren't they?
Right. A little unexpectedly, possibly. I think you're probably thinking in particular of Alan Dulles, who was the great white case officer, as he was known. He was the sort of the first legendary director of the CIA during the 1950s and very much sort of sets the tone. He's tweedy. He's sort of Ivy League. He's Kipling-esque as well. All of this generation of CIA officers have read Kipling's Kim and sort of rather, I think, see themselves in the same tradition, and this ability to engage in espionage and covert action sort of allows them to go and have adventures in foreign lands, and generally sort of emulate the spies of British imperial romantic spy fiction.
And is that kind of closeness? Kim Philby is the famous British traitor. He's the kind of liaison officer, isn't he, between British Secret Service and the CIA, as it comes to be. And he stitches them up royally.
He does indeed. That's absolutely right. He befriends a number of Americans during World War II. People like James Angleton come and join him in London to sort of run Allied counterintelligence. He resumes his friendships with the Americans in the late 1940s when he's sent over to Washington to act as the liaison between MI6 and the new CIA. And of course, during this, he is briefed on various CIA covert operations, including in particular attempts to land agents behind the Iron Curtain in countries like Albania. And he obviously passes on everything he knows to his Soviet controllers. Some Americans are suspicious to give them their due, especially after Guy Burgess flees Washington. He's there as well. The Americans stay in touch with Philby, and Angleton sort of remains a friend of his through the late 1950s and almost right up, in fact, up until Philby actually defects in 1963.
I was going to say, to go back to the foundation, so the OSS, which is the ancestor of the CIA, which is basically the first sort of major American intelligence organization. So that was anti-Nazi, I assume, primarily. But then the CIA is 47, set up by Truman. So do they simply switch targets, or do they get different people in, or how do they adjust from being anti-Nazi to anti-communist? Or was the OSS anti-communist too?
Now, the OSS is actually quite liberal to sort of the extent it has in any politics at all. And there's a lot of this first generation of CI officers, sort of in addition to the kind of Kipling element, they're all quite idealistic as well. Despite their love of things British, there's quite a lot of, they're not actually sort of conscious admirers of the British Empire. If anything, they're sort of anti-colonial. And there is this leftist tinge to the OSS, and their attempts to sort of join up with resistance movements, to the extent that some people outside the OSS, sort of conservative congressmen and what have you, really dislike this organization and see it as a sort of nest of pinkos and possible communists, and this actually sort of haunts the early CIA as well. But in answer to your question, it is much the same personnel basically go to the CIA when it's created in 1947. A number of them, Truman doesn't like espionage, doesn't like covert operations, and he's quite eager to disband the OSS.
Is that because he sees them as un-American?
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. And there is there's this sort of talk of the dangers of creating an American Gestapo around in 1947 when the CIA is created. And Truman obviously has sort of personal misgivings. There's this point he participates in this kind of mock knighting ceremony of his first the first director of Central Intelligence in 47 in the Oval Office, who he gives it to a personal friend, a sort of an old Missouri acquaintance of his, and he declares him the director of centralized snooping. So there's a lot of talk like this around at the time, and Truman is actually kind of acts as a sort of a break on the expansion of the CIA. It's not really until Eisenhower comes along in 1953 that they sort of the White House really lets it loose.
So there's an obvious question, which Mark Kirk Alvis, who I have to say sounds like a CIA operative himself, and Mark asks, was the CIA necessary at its inception? So, ultimately, America is the superpower victor in the Second World War, facing potentially the Soviet Union. Is there no choice but to set up a spy agency?
I think it's bound to happen. It's the sort of the last great power standing, really, isn't it, at the end of World War II, and lacks really any sort of intelligence capabilities after the OSS is disbanded. So I think it's inevitable this is going to be created. And initially, it's very much seen just as an intelligence outfit, an organization that's going to gather intelligence, not necessarily engage in covert action. There's a kind of second phase to its creation, really. Ironically, with George Kennan, who's perhaps best remembered as the architect of containment and this kind of rather subtle intellectual sort of creating Cold War foreign policy in the US. But he's actually behind the scenes. He's also a big advocate of political warfare and psychological warfare and really going after the Soviets and sort of taking the fight to them. And he pushes for, it's not necessarily the CIA at this point, nonetheless, the government having a sort of a covert action capability. So capable, you know, of dropping agents into Albania. And then eventually, come the 1950s, you know, this starts to go into areas of the decolonizing world as well, the global south.
But one of your, I mean, you said that they're suspicious of covert action, but don't they influence the Italian election straight away? I mean, they've only been going for a year. So they're founded in 1947, the Italian elections 48, and they give tons of money to the Christian Democrats.
Wow, basically. Well remembered. Yes, they do. That's true. But it's kind of partly, it's a very sort of patched together effort. There are sort of private citizens involved. Initially, these sorts of operations are given to this, not actually the CIA itself, they're given to this separate unit called the Office of Policy Coordination. So it's housed by the CIA, but it's actually run by the State Department and the Defense Department. And it's not until, I think it's 52 or 53 that it's absorbed by the CIA. So there's this kind of resistance to the idea of sort of the US doing dirty tricks, you know, like the old imperial powers, that it's very much there. And it means that not even the CIA itself actually necessarily wants these things. The second DCI before, the director of Central Intelligence, but before Alan Dulles, Roscoe Hillenkotter, splendid the American name.
What was he called? Roscoe
Hillenkotter. Yes, he's like a military man and very upright, and he actually resists the CIA sort of adopting the powers. But Dominic, yes, you're right. There are operations going on in, first of all, in Europe, in this attempt to sort of stabilize it and prevent a possible communist takeover.
It was the Office of Policy Coordination, was it?
That's right. Yeah.
So this is a euphemism yes, for exactly. Kind of toppling
like foreign governments, basically. Like Universal Exports is James Bond's cover, isn't it?
Right. Yeah. It is clearly a deliberately sort of bland name to divert attention away. Yeah.
But it kind of reflects an American idealism, the notion that America shouldn't be in this dirty business, and yet its existence essentially reflects the fact that America feels that it has to be.
That's just right. Yeah, that there are these, you know, people like there's people like Kennan saying, you know, we need to sort of wise up to our responsibilities and the sort of the dangers of the modern world. And he actually, I think, consciously thinks in terms of, you know, we're so innocent, we need to sort of emulate the old European powers. And then there are sort of people like Alan Dulles, who I think just they love kind of spy games. And they really, you know, Dulles clearly had just loved World War II and helping run the OSS. He wasn't under Bill Donovan, William Wild Bill Donovan, who is the other sort of founding father of US covert operations. And he, I think, just wants more of that. So he's pushing for it as well. I think the sort of picture is of these various kind of intellectuals and former covert operatives sort of almost kind of pushing Washington and people like Truman almost unwillingly towards this.
And the people who are involved in the CIA, just a quick, so, I mean, you mentioned Ivy League earlier. So the sort of stereotype floating around my mind is it's partly that sort of tweedy pipe smoking. So they're all Ivy League, you know, unlike Tom Holland, they would wear the right shoes on a yacht.
Always wear the right shoes on a yacht. That's why I keep bringing it up.
You don't. You were shamed at Cowles, weren't you? Like
yeah,
the Kaiser.
I was, yeah. No, I was. Yes, you're right. Yeah.
So Hugh, they are very much kind of the blue bloods. Are they of kind of East Coast American society, or is it more complicated than that?
This founding generation, you're absolutely right, is very patrician, is very Ivy League. An extraordinary number, if you look at a number just went to this one prep school, Groton, in the sort of the New
like
England
FDR.
Countryside.
FDR's old school.
So that's absolutely right. Yeah, the Roosevelts are everywhere in Groton. The Oyster Bay sort of line of the Roosevelts as well. Teddy and his sons and grandsons all went there as well. Not Teddy himself, but later generations of that branch of the Roosevelt family. And I was looking at a yearbook from Groton in the 1930s, and it's almost like, oh, yeah, I know that name, because so many of them end up in the CIA. It's very much, it's a kind of almost like a faux British public school, and it very much sort of inculcates, you know, classic sort of British virtues of patriotism and service and duty. And these, and also these guys are all reading Kipling and admirers of T. Lawrence. It's that sort of combination of adventurism and a sort of sense of duty, and also aristocratic kind of like, we know best, and we have the right to get up to these sorts of activities, even if some people object. So that, I think they will feed into the early CIA. Yeah.
So Hugh, you mentioned Theodore Roosevelt, and it's his grandson, isn't it? Kermit, the brilliantly named Kermit Roosevelt, which all fans of The Muppet Show always gives a kind of thrill.
A little thrill.
He's a kind of key figure in the Middle East, is that right? And specifically in Iran, which...
Yeah.
And in the early 1950s, Iran becomes the kind of... the showcase for the CIA's involvement in the kind of dirty tricks that British intelligence had played. And indeed, the CIA kind of enters, joins up with British intelligence.
Yes.
Basically to foist a coup in Iran that still influences how Iran sees America to this day. So can you just tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, the background is this sort of veteran Iranian nationalist Mohammad Mossadegh becomes prime minister and nationalizes the Iranian oil industry, which is basically controlled by the British. So they're not at all happy. The Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, I think, is the big, you know, the oil business of the
basically,
day.
It's BP.
Yes,
BP,
it's the precursor to BP, exactly. Yeah. And so it's the British who want rid of him initially. And they sort of realize, partly because a number of them are chased out of Mossadegh's Iran, they need to involve the Americans in order to actually make a coup stick. At this point, they reach out to Kermit Roosevelt, who actually, he has, you know, being a sort of an American aristocrat, there are sort of dynastic ties between him and various British aristocratic families as well. I forget the precise. I mean, he actually, a family friend is the then British foreign secretary, I think. Anyway, so it's all sort of, you know, this is being sort of hatched in clubs in as Roosevelt passes through. And yes, it eventually leads to this coup operation in August 1953, when Roosevelt organizes a lot of sort of former British agents and the Iranian army and some Muslim clerics are involved as well. And anyway, they sort of rally behind the Shah and sort of force this kind of constitutional crisis in which people are forced to choose between the Shah and Mossadegh. And it actually kind of falls apart at one point, this coup plot. Roosevelt is actually sort of ordered to evacuate Tehran, but he, in sort of the adventurous style of the early CIA, says, no, we can still do this, and pays various street mob. A crowd takes over the streets of Tehran on August the 19th, and Mossadegh is basically chased out. And the Iran who's fled, excuse me, the Shah who has fled Tehran at this point, comes back, and it's the sort of beginning of you know, his sort of repressive rule, which, as you say, resistance to it builds. Yeah. And so this is sort of part of the backstory. I mean, there are controversies about exactly how much of the origins of the 1979 Iranian Revolution can be traced directly back to 1953, but clearly it is a big factor.
And so does this give the CIA, I mean, so this is the first sort of great CIA-backed coup, isn't it? Because they have one in Guatemala the following year. And then and then sort of anyone who studies the history of the Cold War in the 60s and 70s, I mean, basically there's a coup every year that people say, oh, that's the CIA who did it, or the CIA's sort of hands are dirty. Do you think that the success of the operation in Iran gave the CIA a taste for meddling, as it were, for toppling governments and stuff? Or was that being overstated a bit?
No, I think that's absolutely right, and it persuades Dwight Eisenhower that covert action is this sort of magic bullet in the Cold War. You know, you can resort to the CIA, and it's cheaper and it's less noisy because you don't want to get into an overt fight with the Soviets for obvious reasons. You know, it could lead to nuclear war, and also, I mean, I think a big part of this as well is that so many of these interventions are covert because with an earlier generation that they might have been over. But you know, this is the sort of the era of decolonization. UN Charter exists now. You know, overt interventionism is sort of no longer allowed in the eyes of the sort of international community. So this is kind of why Washington is often reaches for this weapon in the Cold War. And these early successes in Iran 1953 and Guatemala 1954, they just kind of fuel this growing myth of the ability of the CIA to basically do whatever, you know, overthrow some regimes and support others secretly. So at the same time, this is going on in Vietnam. The CIA is trying to sort of build up. I know you talked about the origins of the Vietnam War in an earlier podcast with Andrew Preston. You know, early on, the CIA attempt to cement Diem into place is very much a CIA operation as well. I mean, it is it is kind of America's army in the Cold War at this point, really. So, yeah.
So we've got a question from Culture Carrot. How many foreign leaders did the CIA conspire to bring down? And which is the most egregious example of misuse of power and why? So that's kind of backing up what you're saying, that the CIA did bring down foreign governments. But that question is in association with another question, which is, does the CIA enjoy a notoriety beyond its station? In other words, does its reputation for bringing down governments mean that it's been blamed for coups and for kind of civil unrest and collapse in foreign countries where it hasn't actually played a role? And what's the balance there, do you think?
Sure. Wow. There is an element to that. I mean, there are some people who actually think that its role in the 1953 Iran coup has been overstated. Right. And actually, you know, it was the local Iranian actors who really were this, you know, they did the decisive things, which is kind of, I think the CIA itself is sort of caught between this desire to sort of boaster of such successes. Yes. And then when it turns out in the long term, perhaps this wasn't such a great idea after all, to sort of, you know, distance itself. So that's that tension you see sort of replicated in the writing about Iran. But I guess that, I mean, Iran is a conspicuous example of regime change by the CIA, Guatemala. A lot of these attempts, in fact, the majority of them, I think, at least in the late 50s and early 60s, are then unsuccessful. You know, Eisenhower keeps reaching for this weapon and it keeps not working. There are failures in Syria, in Indonesia. And then, of course, most of all in Cuba. That's probably the most egregious CIA effort to overthrow a foreign regime is this constant effort to do away with Fidel Castro.
So all the comedy, you know, the things about him, them trying to get his beard to fall out and what is it, kind of exploding seashells on the...
They went to his favourite diving beach and tried to put explosives in a shell that he might reach for. And it's all true. It's all true. No, this all came out in the mid-70s during congressional investigations of the CIA. And it's all documented.
Yeah, they called it Operation Mongoose, didn't they?
That's right, yeah.
And exploding cigar? Exploding cigar was part of it, I think.
Well, there was this attempt, right, to put stuff on his shoes that would cause his beard to fall out, and then I think it was neurotoxins. That's right. It was, so some of it's comical, some of it's just, you know, is actually more sinister. I think it was poisons were going in his cigars. So and then there's an attempt to involve the mafia. You know, the CIA, you know, thinks, you know, who actually really knows to take out people. Yes, we'll, and the FBI puts the CIA in touch with friend and associate of Sam Giancana's, who then tries to get the Havana mob to go after Castro. So it's crazy stuff for sure.
But it's a kind of weird tension between the reputation the CIA in the 60s has as this sinister kind of specter type organization that can pull a string and topple a foreign government, and at the same time these kind of clownish attempts to, you know, with exploding cigars and things. Which do you think did the CIA more damage, a reputation for kind of omniscient, sinister potency, or incompetence? I guess incompetence, really.
Yeah, I think probably initially it's the incompetence that starts to sour people on it in the United States. You know, when it's really Cuba, and first of all, the failed invasion of the Bay of Pigs in 1961, and then the details which emerge of subsequent attempts via Operation Mongoose to assassinate Castro. I think that's when the American public sort of starts to, and some of this starts to come out into the media, you know, Americans start to sort of turn against it. But I mean, there is always this, you know, fear of an American Gestapo and the possibility of this kind of secretive government agency possibly turning against Americans themselves and threatening. You know, this is a sort of old, I think sort of the fear and suspicion of the CIA sort of belongs to this kind of longer tradition of American anti-imperialism, you know, sort of going back centuries, really, and the thought that, you know, overseas adventures and strengthening federal government in order to carry these out might ultimately sort of boomerang against Americans.
So presumably that intensifies in the 60s and into the 70s with the counterculture and the protests against the Vietnam War and so on.
Exactly. So they have a thing, don't they, called Operation Chaos.
Chaos. Who came up with that name?
It's a great name. I mean, if I was going to, frankly, I you were talking about having your own mob. Kermit Roosevelt paid his own mobs. I mean, I'd love to have my own mob, but if I was going to run covert operations, I would call them things like Operation Chaos. But Operation Chaos was about infiltrating the peace movement and sort of Women for Peace and the Black Power movement, Black Panthers and stuff, wasn't it, Hugh?
Yes.
Well, it's a question here from Dr. Navarre. What is the relationship between the CIA and other federal agencies such as the FBI? The FBI is domestic and the CIA is foreign, or am I being too reductive there? So
no, that's absolutely right.
So why is the CIA intervening in domestic? I mean, how do they get away with that?
Well, it's partly because Lyndon Johnson, Operation Chaos, and by the way, that name was just supposedly came just supposedly from a list of, you know, possible operational code names, and that just
Operation Catastrophe, Operation Disaster, Operation Screw Up.
You can't really make it up, can you? No, it had a database of sort of details of, like, peace activists and what have you, and that was called Hydra. You know, it's like they're just. Can we think of any more sinister names? And I should also, you know, in defense of the CIA, an awful lot of this is coming from the White House. You know, there is this tendency on the part of successive U.S. presidents to sort of see the CIA as this kind of private army they can use for any purpose really that they need, and in
Nixon,
this particular instance,
that's
very much Nixon hates
Dominic,
the,
friend of the show, of course.
Yeah, Nixon hates the CIA, you know. Dominic, I'm sure, could speak to this. He thinks they're a bunch of sort of Ivy League eggheads,
yeah, but elitists, but, and closet lefties, I think, is what he thinks.
They do wear the right shoes to the beach.
So he just apparently, you know, presidential briefs from the CIA just sort of piled up in his safe. You know, it was just he never bothered to read them. But when he wanted to get rid of Salvador Allende in Chile, you know, he calls on them because they're useful.
And so Allende, that is the CIA.
Yes, yeah. There are a lot of anti Allende operations run by the CIA during in the years sort of running up to the coup of 1973. But actually, amongst sort of CIA coup operations, I think most historians now tend to see that as actually having the actual overthrow of Allende itself as actually having been less caused by the CIA than in other cases. It was. I mean, they didn't think Pinochet was going to. That, you know, he was barely even on their radar, apparently, the CIA officers.
But doesn't that speak to a bigger issue, Hugh, which is that in a lot of, you mentioned this with 1953 in Iran, that basically we tend, particularly people like, well, sort of anti-establishment people in America and basically everybody outside America, we tend to do what Tom
said. Left-wingers like you, Dominic.
Exactly. Dangerous Marxists.
Yeah.
Like to think of the CIA as a spectre-type organization. You know, it's a classic conspiracy theory. So something happens in a Central American republic and it must be the CIA's fault. And often the CIA are involved, but they're not the key actors. So they end up getting the credit or the blame. But actually, you mentioned Allende. I mean, I would say Allende would probably have fallen anyway, whether the CIA had stayed at home playing backgammon or whether they'd actually got involved. That you know, that's sort of letting his Chilean opponents off the hook in a weird way. There's been some
really great scholarship recently about the role of other South American dictatorships in Allende's overthrow. You know, Brazil played a big covert part in this as well. But then as I was saying earlier, that this has even gone into the Iran coup, and there've been these kind of retrospective attempts to almost excuse the US and the CIA, and actually, you know, blame it all on the Ayatollahs, right? This is actually so in other words, the sort of stressing local agency and saying no, this wasn't just the case of the CIA turning up with some bags of gold and then sort of, you know, turning this sort of third world backwater, you know, into everything happening at the.
And did they carry on with exploding cigars and things? Was that the kind of cool gadgets that
they carry on with?
Well, it's what people really want to know, I think. I mean, do they have, because the whole exploding cigars, did they just think this is a terrible idea, we're going to park it? Or did their top boffins crack how to get exploding cigars? Because if they did, presumably, we wouldn't know, would we? So we'd only hear about the failures.
Well, some of this actually, some of the gadgets actually, and are coming from, well, and again, Dominic will like this, they're coming from Bond. There's this, Fleming is at sort of dinner parties with Dulles and John Kennedy, and he is describing MI6 gadgets and then some of the things that, you know, feature in his novels, and apparently Alan Dulles runs off excitedly to see if the CIA boffins can replicate this in their laboratories. So apparently, including Rosa Klebb's poison knife, you know, that
sticks, it comes out of a shoe.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yes. Apparently Dulles was very interested in this gadget.
That's absolutely laughable. They were copying
But I should also say that the CIA is actually quite, out of the various forms of intelligence, you know, there are these abbreviations for human intelligence and techint, technological intelligence. Well, the CIA is actually, I mean, overall, it's probably not terribly good at human intelligence. You know, notoriously, it fails to really kind of, you know, get much good intelligence, human intelligence from the Soviet Union, and then later from the, you know, the next big enemy from Al Qaeda and other Islamist organizations. But what it is pretty good at is things like. The U2 is a CIA operation. You know, it's the CIA that comes up this extremely effective spy
not,
plane.
Yeah, not the band.
Not the band.
That's
there are CIA links to the police.
Of course, Miles Copeland's dad. Yes.
Yes, exactly. Yes, yes.
So, what was Miles Copeland's dad? Was he a major figure in the CIA?
He was quite big in the Middle East. He was a Kermit Roosevelt's kind of lieutenant, as it were. He's not very heavily involved in Iran, but he's very sort of active in the Arab countries, and he's very good at cultivating human intelligence sources. He befriends NASA, for example. And
that's amazing! What a link!
To the police.
I think we should take a break at this point.
We should,
and I think when we come back, we should look at those two failures that you mentioned. Because the CIA didn't really predict the fall of the Soviet Union, and it didn't really get a handle on the rise of Al-Qaeda and Islamist militism. So when we come back, we talk about that. We will see you in a minute or two. Hello, welcome back to The Rest is History. We are talking the Central Intelligence Agency. And Hugh, I've got a question here from Alan Andrew Wild. In pursuing American interests, has the CIA ever been a source for good? And I guess you'd say that for all its, you know, its fondness for coups and its exploding cigars and so on, you'd back the CIA over, say, the KGB, and you'd back them over Al-Qaeda. And in the 80s and the 90s, those were the two great enemies of the CIA, I guess. So how would you see the kind of the moral balance of the CIA in the 80s and 90s into the 21st century?
It's an intriguing question. It does the CIA, despite the sort of comical elements, its operations are effective in the '80s, especially in helping defeat the Soviets in Afghanistan. You know, the CIA supplies the Mujahideen with weapons, the Stinger, those Stinger missiles they fired at the helicopters, Soviet
so that's
helicopters.
Rambo. Is Rambo in the CIA?
I don't think he is. Well, no, I
there's
think,
no
I think he's
CIA
just, he's
presence,
a grunt. He's
I
a...
have to say, in the Living Daylights. So that's just Bond. There's no CIA men there.
Right. So although the CIA is in other Bond, isn't it? Felix Leiter. He's
Felix.
Yes.
But yeah, Felix is never instrumental.
Guys,
Felix
guys.
Is only ever supplying gadgets and stuff.
He's a sidekick, isn't he?
Yeah. Dominic, we're not focusing on fantasy here. We're focusing on
okay,
the reality of the CIA's engagement in these titanic global conflicts.
You mentioned Rambo. There's no doubt.
I know I did. I know I did, but I can just throw that out because I know that we're not going to discuss it. But if we get into Bond, it's like kind of going down into quicksand with you.
Okay. All right. Sorry.
Let's not talk about fictional agents. Let's talk about... say in Homeland.
Well, no, I mean the relationship between the CIA and culture is very interesting. You know, I think just talking a bit earlier about Kipling and Alan Dulles. You know, I think fiction really does sort of shape the CIA's attitude towards a number of things. And there's this kind of there's the gadget thing, you know, coming out of Fleming, and also then it's going the other way as well. You know, the CIA it does somewhat try to shape culture in
but
for Cold War propaganda.
You've written
purposes,
a book about this. You've written a whole book about this. So
I've been trying to turn the conversation around to
this his own book. Tom Holland is a master at that. So you wrote a book called a brilliant book called The Mighty Wurlitzer, which is all about the CIA sponsoring what? Jackson Pollock? Literary
Jackson
magazines.
Pollock?
Yeah. He's promoted
Why are they
by the CIA.
Jackson Pollock?
You tell the story better than me.
He's just kind of flicking paint, isn't he?
Well, we'll see if I do. So, yeah, this is the so-called Cultural Cold War. It's the idea that the US is sort of trying to fight this international image of itself as it's all Disney and Coca-Cola. So in order to sort of, you know, win over neutralist intellectuals in Europe and then possibly a bit beyond in the so-called third world, you need to persuade them that actually America has a high cultural life of its own. And, you know, the Soviets are sort of, Soviet propagandists are making hay out of this as well. You know, we have the Bolshoi, we have Tolstoy, what do the Americans have? So the CIA secretly funds this organization called the Congress for Cultural Freedom, which sponsors tours of Europe and further afield by the Boston Symphony Orchestra, for example, you know, to show what accomplished classical musicians the US has, and traveling exhibits featuring the abstract expressionists. This is sort of in partnership with the Museum of Modern Art in New York, and amongst them Jackson Pollock. So this is really, I mean, perhaps this is could be part of a response to that earlier question about this, the CIA really being pretty clever, right? You know, being pretty subtle.
Am I imagining that they sponsored Orwell? Have I not got that right?
Well, Orwell has a relationship with a sort of equivalent secret British organization, the Information Research Department in
that's
the British
not
Foreign Office. No, but actually there is a Orwell CIA link as well, because the CIA... animates Animal Farm.
The cartoons.
I mean, it's actually, you know, it's a great movie. It's a sort of landmark in the history of animation. And it's a CIA operation from beginning to end. You know, they think the Animal Farm could be this sort of tremendous anti-communist propaganda, and they rent this production company based in the UK in order to animate it, and it's in the movie theaters, it's in the it's shown in classrooms for generations afterwards.
And is that ongoing? So my brilliant impression of Liam Neeson in Taken, which we started this podcast with, I mean, are the CIA behind the scenes kind of encouraging the presentation of the CIA in a positive way in film and TV? And I'd say there's, what's his name? Jack, what's his name? Tom Clancy and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah, Jack Ryan.
Jack Ryan,
yes, yeah. There is, I think after we touched on this briefly earlier, you know, all of this stuff about Castro and MH Chaos, etc., comes out in the 70s. And then actually the CIA hasn't been terribly attentive to its own sort of public relations up until that point. But in the late 70s and 80s, it starts to become so, and eventually actually creates its a unit basically for liaising with Hollywood and various other cultural entities, and plays a role in various movie productions. Zero Dark Thirty, you know, the movie about the hunt for Bin Laden, that has there is quite a lot of consultation between the director and producer and the CIA.
Because there was a point, wasn't there, when the first revelations came out about the CIA sponsoring the Congress for Cultural Freedom, and then the revelations about the exploding cigars and stuff, the CIA was kind of toxic in American, certainly in American kind of intellectual circles. It was seen as, you know, evil assassins and shambling clowns and stuff. But has that reputation changed? Do people, certainly after 9/11, are people more benignly disposed towards the CIA now?
Yeah, I think it did enjoy, I mean, it kind of, its popularity revived somewhat during the 1980s, you know, during the Reagan era. So that was a sort of a renaissance for the CIA. But then there was a further one.
And the first book, President Bush had been a director of the CIA.
Yes, he had indeed. That's correct. Yeah. So I guess it reaches a sort of nadir in the early noughties, you know, with 9/11 and the WMBD debacle, yeah, and failure to catch Bin Laden and so on. So then after Bin Laden after the CIA catches up with him, it sort of enjoys a revival then.
Well, so I would say over the past decade, that the sense I have, which I'm sure must be not entirely true because I'm only getting it from newspapers, but that the action is going on online, that it's kind of cyber terrorism, cyber wars, whatever, and the sense that certainly Russian intelligence is now very, very focused on the cyber. And to be honest, the Chinese, I've got no idea even what the name of the Chinese spy agency is. And I wonder, in comparison to these much, much more kind of shadowy figures, is the CIA kind of a bit prehistoric in comparison?
It's an interesting notion. I mean, I think it is trying very much to sort of adopt to this kind of new world of cyber threats, et cetera. And I don't think so. I mean, I think it's probably still something of a leader in that sort of realm of technological intelligence as well. I mean, some people, you know, the 2016 Russian election interference, you know, a lot of some commentators have seen that as sort of blowback from earlier CIA operations, that right, the kind of the Russians were sort of imitating what the Americans would be doing to the Iranians.
Oh yes, of course, because the CIA were with Mossad were kind of deprogramming Iranian nuclear reactors and things.
Stuxnet, that's right. Yes, exactly. Yeah. The unleashing viruses on them.
So basically, is what's happening at the moment that in the background, in cyberspace, where most of us have no idea what's going on? Yeah, okay. So we don't know.
No one knows. That's okay. So Hugh, I'll tell you one thing I'm very disappointed about. We have not mentioned, I was really hoping we'd mention, an alumnus of my old school. So I'm always...
I think I know where you're going with this.
As a proud old Malvernian, I'm always pleased to get my old school into podcast, and I've completely failed so far in this entire series. But now we can talk about a man called, with a splendid name of James Jesus Angleton.
Jesus, thank God. I thought we were going to miss out.
Tom Holland, desperate to get Christianity in. So
it should actually be James... This is the height of pedantry. James Jesus Angleton, because his mother was Mexican.
But you sound ridiculous.
He's a very interesting soul.
But you can't call yourself James Jesus. Either got to be James Jesus or James Jesus, right? You've got to be consistent. Right. Anyway, listen. James Jesus Angleton.
Okay.
He went to my old school, and he was the head of counterintelligence at the CIA, I think from 1954 to 1974.
What was he doing at your old school?
Well, he was having a first-class education. What else?
But
what do you mean?
Why didn't he go to an American school?
I think he
kind of popped up in Herefordshire or wherever.
Hugh, you'll know the answer to this, do you?
Yes, I think I do. No, his father is a sort of international businessman. He's based in international. Yes, there you go. Which makes him. Yes, I know. That sounds like right. A euphemism for. No, I don't think his father is a spy. Well, I said that actually. No, he does play a role in the OSA.
Had a mountaintop lair in Switzerland and a submarine that could swallow ships.
Cigar.
Right. Anyway, let's get back to him because he was a brilliant man because he was completely paranoid. Yes. And he believed that the CIA was full of communists. He believed that
so he
Harold
was a paranoid
Wilson,
right-wing zealot.
He believed
he?
That Harold
Dominic,
Wilson was a communist.
He went to your school.
He did.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. I know some people. It was that or become a very popular mid-market newspaper columnist. I mean, it was one or the other. He kept telling MI5 that Harold Wilson was a communist.
Yes.
He also told the Canadians that their Prime Minister, Lester Pearson, was a communist. He told the Australians that their Prime Minister...
as well, the man running the Mounties counterintelligence, he was too. Yeah.
The Mounties were run by the KGB. Yes. So he believed everybody was penetrated by the KGB, including the most anodyne and bland people imaginable. And yet they kept him on for 20 years. He's kind of going around.
Yeah.
Saying, you know, you'd
he does actually, he prevents communist penetration. I mean, this actually works, this paranoia. You know, the CIA, while he's in running its counterintelligence, is not penetrated by Soviet moles, where, you know, at the same time that I don't really need to spell it out, do I? The MI6 is thoroughly penetrated by Philby et al. So, and then after he's retired, you know, he's kind of forced out because of this paranoid mole hunt he runs. Aldrich Ames, who's the sort of, you know, the most damaging Soviet mole in CIA history happens along fairly soon after he leaves the picture. So, but yeah, no, he is undoubtedly paranoid. It's partly because I think because when Philby defects, you know, this comes as because he's one of Philby's biggest American buddies. They have a lot of boozy lunches together when Philby is running the ASNR in Washington. So I think this comes as a sort of a really big personal blow to Angleton, who very much, you know, he absorbed those gentlemanly values, you know, patriotism, service, etc. while attending Melbourne College.
Yeah,
hurrah for your old school, Dominic. I mean, obviously, the idea that the CIA is sponsoring this podcast is a ludicrous one.
Unimaginable. I think if they were going to sponsor a podcast,
my cigar's just exploded.
You might not have picked up on it, but I'm putting a positive spin on everything they did, you see. I'm getting it in there.
So, Hugh, what was the worst thing they did? I mean, can I make a suggestion and then you can tell me why I'm wrong? Isn't it sometimes said that Indonesia is their worst because they encouraged the purge of communists in the mid-60s that killed
thousands. Die in that.
A million people, some people say.
A million?
Yeah, a million. No. Yeah. And the CIA, I read online, I mean, admittedly it was only online, so it may be utterly untrue, that a CIA report had sort of set its own report into it, said, you know, this was as bad as Nazi mass murders or something. Mm-hmm. Let's hush it up. Hugh, is that all exaggerated, or is there some?
No, I don't think it is. Amid all the laughter, right? It does. You know, a lot of these operations do, you know, lead to very, very bad things. Iran, Guatemala, you know, the country after Jacobo Arbenz, democratically elected president, is overthrown, and I think, you know, the finger really does point at the CIA and at Washington with that one. You know, the country descends into a bloodbath. Not even the colonel who the CIA helped install this is sort of excused this. He's assassinated a few years later. The operation against Patrice Lumumba, president, that's absolutely ghastly as well. Yeah. It's not actually the CIA,
because they send an executioner over, don't they? I mean, someone who's kind of practiced in poisoning. And
yes, they send some of these poisons,
the doctor or something, sinister figure from a Conrad novel.
Yeah, Sidney Gottlieb, the sort of slightly Doctor Strangelove-ish character,
something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, he cooks up these poisons and dispatches them to the CIA station in the Congo to get rid of the Mumba. The CIA doesn't sort of get to him first, Congolese rivals of his and Belgians, Belgian mercenaries do. And but you know, his murder is, you know, it's just horrible.
Okay.
And the CIA undoubtedly sort of contributes to this sort of atmosphere of murder and mayhem that surrounds him when he's eventually killed.
Well, Hugh, I mean, obviously, we're not sponsored by the CIA. That would be an absolutely shameful allegation. But I think that before we go, just one last question from Danny Kay. What was the CIA's greatest achievement?
Okay, well,
so we've done the bad. What's the good?
We've probably focused more on covert action. It's kind of some successful operations like Iran ultimately have bad unintended consequences. So it's if you sort of look at the kind of the ledger for covert action, I don't think it's favorable to the CIA, but its intelligence record, I think, is actually kind of better than it's sometimes been given credit for. I mean, there are some really egregious failures, you know, like 9/11, the failure to predict the collapse of the Soviet Union. I mean, big ones. But the CIA is very important in the it has some successes as well, like the Cuban Missile Crisis. You know, it does very well there. Actually, a lot of the intelligence it provides during the Vietnam War is very sensible as well. It takes a pretty dim view of U.S. prospects in that war from early on. So
I suppose also a lot of these things, actually their successes we probably don't know about, because, you know, that's the point, isn't it?
Well, you know, I now... Tom, that's actually a favourite sort of CIA publicity line. It is. You know, we have so many successes, but we can't tell you about them. So,
well, there it is. I've smuggled it in. I hope my controller in Langley will give me a free cigar for that. Hugh, thanks so much. It's been a brilliant whistle stop tour through what's a fascinating subject.
It's a weird and wonderful subject, isn't it? Yeah, thank
it
you.
Is.
So,
thank you.
For those of you listening, be careful with your next cigar. Don't pick up a seashell. And if you find your beard, if you're a hipster and you find your beard mysteriously sparser tomorrow, wait till you listen to next week's The Rest is History and find out what happens then. Goodbye.
Okay. Bye-bye.